Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, spending time with Professor Douglas Boyne. His new book is Claudia, Champion of Rome. Claudia, born 95, has a younger brother who's ambitious and leads the tribunes to correct and reform the Roman conduct at the time of their maturity. Claudia's, our heroine, loses her husband suddenly after he's consul. He dies 4 months later. Metellus is gone. She has a daughter, and she's unmarried. But because of a confusion of inheritance laws, which will be corrected later in favor of the men, she inherits not only her father's portion but of her dowry, but also her husband's estates, and becomes extremely wealthy, not under a mandate to marry right away, doesn't need to. She sponsors her younger brother, the tribune. This leads her to be an independent woman, which is generally understood to be a little outside of the rules book in Rome, but accepted. However, there's a man named Cicero. We've introduced him. He's been consul. He's now a magic voice. You hire him when you're in trouble. He also is obsessed with Claudia. Why? We don't know, do we, Douglas? We don't know what that fascination is for him.
We really don't. And it's hard to admit that we really don't. Plutarch, who is writing much later and, you know, always has the colorful vignettes that we expect to find in a Shakespearean play, says that, you know, he was obsessed with her in a kind of romantic way. And there's just nothing we can use to document that. But he does seem to have taken quite an interest in her, even at her husband's inauguration. We get the first inclination, we get the first real hint from Cicero's letters that she's gotten under his skin. He says, I can't stand the confident airs of that woman. And he won't even say her name. And this is how she enters the history books as a third person, in an unnamed third person that one of her peers can't even, whose name a peer can't even say out loud. So something about her antagonized him, riled him up, and that's fascinating.
The professor is being modest about how he achieved all these facts. It's an enormous jigsaw puzzle, most of which is missing. And so, so you get imagine doing a jigsaw puzzle where you get one piece in the midst of a design, but you're never going to get the rest of the design. It's not going to come 2,000 years later. And we have, how does he refer to her? Cow-eyed of Hera. What does that mean to him? Cow-eyed?
This is Cicero's phrase. In, you know, of the evidence that we do have, you know, because a reader, I'm always sensitive to a reader, I think, kind of starts to gloss over the page the more times that a historian says we don't know. So I am very stingy with admitting on the page what we don't know. I just do the best with what we have and I move on. And one of the richest narratives that I think emerges from what we do have are letters that Cicero has exchanged to a very good friend of his. And over the course of 1 year, 59 BCE, which is a kind of pivotal year for the Republic, Caesar is in charge. Pompey is, you know, behind the scenes. Crassus is lurking. All of the players are here. You know, Cicero is reaching out to his friend and very interested to find out what is being manipulated behind the scenes that might involve him and his potential exile. So something has taken place in Cicero's biography that has put him in legal jeopardy. And this legal jeopardy is looming over his year. It's making him quite anxious. The narrative tone of the letters changes from the beginning of the year to the end of the year as he grows increasingly panicked that someone is going to hold him to account for some legal malfeasance that he's done. And Clodia is the linchpin of the source for what he needs to know. And he's quite disdainful, but also kind of backhanded, complimentary to her. He calls her Hera, you know, so he assumes that she's the wife of the king of Mount Olympus. She's all knowing, all seeing, involves herself in every deliberation. That's kind of one part of it. And that's the kind of cow-eyed Hera quote is Homeric. It's drawn from the Iliad, which gives her this kind of panoptic vision. But it isn't, I don't think, in a straightforward nickname. I think there's something quite derogatory about it for certain. And he won't limit himself to that. When he really gets riled up by her ability to pull strings behind the scenes of the Republic, he accuses her of incestuous relations with her brother in a way that would, for a Roman, equate to the Ptolemies of Egypt. So this is a kind of way to make her foreign, to make her non-Italian, non-Roman. She's like those Greek Egyptian, you know, queens and kings who all sleep with each other. He really, really had an antipathy towards her.
The MacGuffin we're about to talk to, this is what a Hitchcock movie says. Everybody in the drama cares about it, but it's not very important. The MacGuffin here is the murder of a diplomat from Egypt. And a young man named Rufus is accused inferentially. We're being responsible for the death. Why Rufus? Because Rufus is a young man, ambitious, living in an apartment on Palatine Hill that pays rent to Clodia, now a widow, and a widow who likes romance, has always liked romance. And the assumption is that Rufus, much younger than she, were companions for several years in the real estate that Clodia inherits. She's in the Palatine Hill. She has a house outside, Solinium, the family home. She has a villa at the crater, that's Naples, near Vesuvius. And she has land across the Tiber. She's very rich. And she and Rufus are an item. And then they aren't. One day, Clodia's slaves, the people who work for her, say that Rufus is getting ready to kill her, to poison her. And they declare that he's a threat. Clodia, using her brother Clodius's extreme power at the moment, having exiled Cicero for misbehavior, and all of this is important to prosecute Rufus, and Clodia is going to be the major witness. Now we come to the drama of dramas. Remember, Caesar's watching this, Pompey's watching this, Crassus outside. They're watching this happen because it's a contest between the Senate and the populares, between ambitious young woman who is keen on pressing her political power and the establishment that is all male all the time. We come to a courtroom, and the courtroom with 51 jurors on a holiday. Why is that significant, Professor, that they have the trial, a two-day trial, you tell me, on a holiday? It's in the forum, right? But nobody's in attendance.
That's exactly right. It's paradoxically so important. The charges that have been bundled under the rubric of sedition are so important that they can be held on a public holiday that, paradoxically, everyone is at the racetrack watching the games that day when the trial takes place. And this is played to some effect by the defense. I don't think the prosecution ever had a kind of smart understand. I think the prosecution was a little bit tone deaf about how to manage this case, but that's where we are. You mentioned the MacGuffin. You know, I'm a huge Hitchcock fan. You and I were talking about this in the beginning of our Zoom, that kind of ploy to start the train ride and have the protagonists take a kind of cross-country escapade. And for me, this trial, the kind of murder of the diplomat, and the reason the book is structured the way that the book is structured from a kind of historical point of view, is quite frankly, the true crime element has, I think, been well tested in narrative nonfiction writing as an easy way to move into complicated, complex social topics. And, you know, instead of kind of telling people from the outset, you know, here is a a prequel to the assassination of Julius Caesar, you know, I wanted to do something a little bit more surprising. And so to give people this murder trial that ends up backing into a kind of huge, you know, a kind of scene setting environment for the late first century was important to me.
And it's worthwhile to mention that Cicero is going to be, it's the economy of scene is incredible. It's just as if there's a playwright here. Cicero and Clodio are going to be in a courtroom together. And the accused is a former paramour of Clodia. She disdains him now, especially since he might have been trying to poison her. He's associated with the poison death of the diplomat from Egypt. All that is a backstory that will turn into Cleopatra and Mark Antony, but that's later. Right now, Mark Antony's also present at a distance here. They're all there. It's incredible. The only one I missed for a while is Octavian. I'm sure he's coming up in the next chapter. So, but the moment, the payoff is Cicero's condemnation of Clodia in order to convince the jury that Rufus would not have done such a thing as murder a diplomat. He's a bright young man who was seduced by an older, wily woman who worships at, you know, whatever disdainful fashion Cicero can call up. His condemnation of Clodia, the professor tells me, is studied for the next 2,000 years. Is that correct, Douglas?
It really is. The we can follow the text of Cicero's speech in front of the jury. We can follow it in Latin from the time it's delivered through the early classrooms of the Roman Empire, when it shows up on papyrus in schoolhouse excavations, through medieval monasteries where it appears in scriptoria of the 8th and 9th century. We can thank Renaissance book hunters like Poggio Bracciolini for detecting traces of it in earlier manuscripts and hunting it down in 12th century France. There are copies that are still in the Bibliothèque Nationale of Paris. And we can, from there, go directly into the British school system. And quite frankly, we can follow it all the way back to Loyola Academy in Chicago, where as a 16-year-old, I read it. And that text had a remarkable longevity to it. It started my Latin career. It started my kind of interest in classics as a young kid. And it's a challenging text, to put it mildly, because of how one-sided and lopsided Cicero makes the history and how misogynistic he is towards Clodia. And so really what I wanted to do with the climax of this book was take as much of his words as I could give in translation, in my own translation, and use it in a kind of big moment of revelation that was the climax of her life, not his, and just make sure that we got a different perspective on it than we had for as long as it's been studied.
The payoff is that Cicero gets Rufus off. We believe it's Cicero who convinces the jury that this bright young man who has a great future in front of him wouldn't dare have killed an Egyptian diplomat with poison, nor was he a threat to his former paramour who disdains him and is now condemning him in a fashion that is unworthy of Rome, that kind of thing. So, but that's not the end of the story. That might be the end of Cicero in the courtroom with Clodia, but there's much more when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. The book is Clodia of Rome. Douglas Boyne is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.